Well, a new study finds that in ads, political speeches, and other messages that are meant to have manipulative intent, three claims will persuade someone, but four or more will make people feel skeptical. Here to tell us more is the lead author of that study, Professor Kurt Carlson. He's a professor of marketing at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business and the director of the Georgetown Institute for Consumer Research, and he writes a blog on decision-making for Psychology Today. Welcome, Professor Carlson.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Before we go any further, how about them Badgers?
Yeah, they're doing all right, aren't they?
They are. You are an original Wisconsinite.
I am. I grew up in Kenosha, and I went to school at UW-Madison.
Okay. Awesome. Well, we appreciate you joining us tonight. So I was really interested when I read the blurb about this study, and I have been reading about what you do, and I see that you study how people, especially consumers, make decisions. Tell us about the kinds of things you research.
Well, you're right. I mean, if there's a person making a decision at the end of it, I'm interested in how the person got to that point. So I study the origins of people's choices. I look at things like the problems that people are having that are going to be the leading indicators of the choices that they make. As a part of the Institute, we have an ongoing survey of consumer problems. It's the first of its type in the world that is tracking the different problems that consumers have over time in various categories and how they plan to solve them. Then once someone gets into the market and starts looking for a solution, I'm interested in understanding sort of how they form their preferences and what those weak preferences that are sort of sitting in their mind, what those preferences do to the remainder of the process. I'm interested in trying to figure out ways to get them out of people's minds. I have a stream of research that looks at that, a couple of cute tricks that allow me to do things like predict how undecided voters are going to break in the election and get people to reveal their preferences even when they don't want me to. Those are kind of nefarious.
But sounds interesting.
Yeah. It's, basically, the trick in that research is what nobody realized is that if you have a weak preference, you're actually perfectly happy to try and gather as much information, and particularly negative information, about that item. It's very different than if you have a very strong preference, like a strong political allegiance, mm-hmm. where you only want to hear good things about the candidates you like. It turns out that when we have these really weak emerging preferences, we are looking for negative information about them. And so all I need to do is ask somebody, you know, if you were going to read two reviews about this product that were negative, you know, if you read a negative review about one product or a negative review about the other, which would you prefer to read a negative review about? And that tells me which way they're thinking, which way they're leaning in their mind a really high percentage of the time, about 70% of the time. So I've worked on that stuff that looks at on how to get these preferences out of people's heads, and in some cases even help people reveal these preferences to themselves. Maybe I don't know that I have a preference, and I can reveal that to myself by figuring out which alternative I want to read negative information about.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, I'd like to, a little later on in this conversation, I'd like to ask you about decision-making and some of those aspects. Let's focus for a second on the study that we talked about in the intro. You focused on the number of claims about something that people find persuasive. Please describe that, if you would, and how it was set up.
Sure. So it turns out that there's just a lot of evidence that the number three is kind of really important in our culture. Seems to be sort of universal. We think it goes back to the notion that people think they're seeing sort of something pretty completely if they see three dimensions of it. If they see sort of its, you know, height, its width, and its depth, and I kind of know its full spatialness. And if I have three orthogonal dimensions of something described, I kind of know everything that there is to know about it. So we started with that idea, and we said, all right, if that's true, then anybody who describes someone or something using more than three independent dimensions is going to look like they're trying too hard. And that might not always hurt. You know, if you're just describing a tree in your backyard, you know, what's the big deal if you over-describe it? But in a lot of situations where people are trying to persuade others to change their behavior or to act in a certain way, the person that is being spoken to knows what the game is. I realize that you're trying to persuade me. So in those circumstances, we figured if you go too far, if you over-describe the thing, you go beyond those three dimensions, they're going to say, all right, now you're really trying too hard. Something's wrong here. It can't be that good.
And you really did find that.
That's exactly what we found. We looked at a bunch bunch of different categories. We looked at things like restaurants and politicians and cereal and people dating their old flame. So, you know, where I'm back together with my old flame and I'm trying to convince a friend that what I'm doing is smart. And in every one of these cases, if you make three positive claims about the thing that you're talking about, a restaurant, a cereal, a politician, that's good. Three is better than two. And four is just substantially worse than three. So if you want an example, I mean, you know, the cereal one, it was an advertisement for a cereal. And the cereal was described using a bunch of different positive claims. And those included being healthier and better tasting, organic, and higher quality. If you take any three of those and present them, the attitude toward the cereal is pretty positive. And if you present any four of those, it's worse than if you just presented three, and not really different than if you presented two.
I love this. It's just, it's really interesting result. It jives with my, I don't know, my sense that, for one thing, odd numbers are always seem to be more interesting than even ones. But also, like in studying writing, you know, you learn to give three adjectives or three, you know, three descriptions, not more.
Yeah, yeah, particularly if you're in persuasive writing, it really seems to matter. What we found is that if you're not trying to persuade, or if the reader or the observer, the target, is, does not believe you're trying to persuade them, then four is not worse than three. Actually, in some cases, it's a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But when the person on the other side might think that you're trying to persuade them, as is the case in almost all of marketing and a lot of communication, then stopping at three is a good thing.
So because you, of course, are working in marketing at the business school, how will these findings be applied in the business world in a practical sense?
That's a great question. You know, I think that if you're faced with a circumstance where you have four claims that you want to make because you're superior to one of your competitor's products, you know, you're going to have to hold off and present three of them. Or, alternatively, we've done a little bit of work on two, if you can find a way to group two of them together into a category, people will treat it like it's one thing. So we ran a study where we had eight positive claims, and we grouped them into three categories with, you know, headings on them, and that worked better than the separating the eight claims individually. But it might be that, you know, there are some cases where you have to have five dimensions described of something, or else it's going to seem incomplete. And in that case, you're kind of stuck. We would say that the way around that is to, you know, make three big groups and make sure that you put the five claims separately in those three groups. And then if you're just looking for claims, try not to go beyond three, because it's just going to seem like you're trying too hard.
Mm-hmm. And but this holds true for any number of categories, right? Like what you studied, like people or political claims, or it's not just, you know, dishwashing soap.
You know, I can't believe how robust this study was. We never found a circumstance where it didn't work. We looked in a lot of them. Every time we ran it, it just kept working. So, yes, it works if a politician is making claims about what makes them particularly good for election. It works if a friend is making statements to a friend of hers about why she's back together with her boyfriend, her old boyfriend that she broke up with before. It works for products and for services. We haven't found a place where it doesn't work yet.
That's great. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Professor Kurt Carlson. He's a professor of marketing at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business, and he's talking with us about how people make decisions. Well, Professor Carlson, why is decision making such an interesting topic? Because it really is.
Are you asking me why I find it interesting,
yeah,
or why I think other people should find it interesting?
Both. Tackle one first.
You know, I have always wondered why people do what they do. When I was little, I wanted to be an inventor. I tried to make a sprinkler jump rope. It was basically a hose that you'd run water through, and you would try and jump rope with it.
That sounds fun.
Turns out when you fill a hose with water, it gets really heavy. It's more of a more of a weapon than a toy. So I decided I wasn't going to make it as an inventor, and I got around to inventing studies of why people do what they do. I took my two big passions and put them together. And so I love figuring out why people do, and I love inventing studies to try and make that happen. Why do I think other people should care about decision making?
Yeah.
I think it's really the only controllable way that you can have positive influence on your life. There are positive things that can happen to you that don't involve you making decisions. And you can make decisions and they can lead to bad things. But if you want to actually exert positive change on your life, there's really only one way you can do that. And that's through the choices you make. So we might as well understand the limitations to making good choices and how the context of the situation influences the choices we make so that we can make better choices and little by little make ourselves and the world better.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, you anticipated my next question, which was I read in your Psychology Today blog that you, as you just said, believe choices are the only way to make positive change in one's life. Tell us about the gun to your head experiment. Because I thought that was a really instructive way to think about things.
Yeah, when you're faced with a statement like the only way to exact positive change in your life is through the choices you make, one of the things that comes up is you say, well, but I don't have as many choices. I don't have a lot of choices. So it's really easy to fall into the trap that we just take the world as it is, we take the circumstance as it is, and we accept the choices that are in front of us. My most influential mentors, I've had three of them, have all been really good at rejecting the set of choices that are in front of them. They all basically create new choices from whatever set's given them.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, so you get a call from somebody and your professor, and they say, we'd like you to come and give a talk. And you think to yourself, well, I'm not sure I have time to do that. You can either say one choice is yes, the other choice is no, right? It seems pretty obvious. But if you're really creative, you might say, maybe before I come and give a talk, I can run a study with the people that are going to be in attendance. And then I can use some of that data both for my research and for the talk itself, killing two birds with one stone. And so you can create a third alternative that actually makes the choice beneficial for everybody. And the best people I've ever worked with, my best mentors, were just naturally did this. So the gun to your head thing says, look, in a lot of situations, you're going to take the circumstance as it is and believe you don't have a choice. If you really want to know whether or not you have a choice, play the following trick on yourself. Imagine that someone has a gun to your head and says, do something different. Or, you have to do this. Could you do it? And if the answer comes back, yes, I could do it, well, then you have a choice. You may not like the choice you have, but you have a choice. And so when you use a simple little trick like that, you can reveal all kinds of choices where otherwise you might have assumed you don't have them. And I think just having that mentality that there's choices is both empowering and it leads us down the path to making better choices to improve our lives.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Well, where can people find your blog?
The title of the blog is Origin of Choices, and it's on the Psychology Today webpage. If you search for me by name, Kirk Carlson, or you search Origin of Choices, you can find it there. You can also find it linked to from the Institute webpage, the Georgetown Institute for Consumer Research, which is sponsored by KPMG. You can type in Georgetown Institute for Consumer Research and find it through there as well.
Okay. And before we let you go, what single idea about decision making would you like our listeners to take away from this conversation?
Oh, gee. Use choices as a way to exact positive change on your life. Try to create new choice alternatives when presented, and then look for ones that are going to lead you to the change that you want to see.
All right. Well, Professor Carlson, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. It was fun to hear from you, and we really appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome, man. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.